Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, we visit with Dr. Travis Leglider, Extension Weed Specialist with the University of Kentucky. And as always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Hey, Jay.
How is how's David and Vicky doing today?
Doing good. It's a pretty day out. We've got have had a mild winter and have coming out of this spring. Could be an early spring. I'm not sure exactly what's going to transpire, but when this show airs, we'll be getting pretty doggone close to soybean and corn planting time.
Yeah, actually, we're recording this a couple of weeks before it is going to air.
Yep.
Like we do a lot of them, we try to put them together a little bit in advance, so we've got some built out. We're not to the last minute getting it all done, but today's one of those shows that we're going to try to get it out as quickly as possible, just because of the nature and the timing of the topics that we're talking about. It got our guest with us today, Travis Leglider. Good morning, sir.
Morning. How is everybody?
We're doing very well, and we've been at this a while today. This is our last one for today, so we might get a little stir crazy before it's all over, but. Going to talk a little bit today about weed control options. Of course, the hot button topic for everybody right now is dicamba. Want to make note of the fact that this show is going to air the second week of April, or excuse me, the first week of April. So we're actually a couple of weeks of a lag time between now and the time that it airs. So some things could change between now and then. But how's everything going today? And what's the latest buzzword on dicamba?
Yeah, so everything's pretty good. It's been quiet for a couple weeks now, I guess I'll put it that way.
It's a good thing. That's a good thing.
Yeah. So, yeah, about the time I thought everything was going to be normal. So, as everybody knows, on February 6th, the dicamba labels, and to be specific, the Extendamax, Ingenia, and Tavium labels. So those are the three products that are allowed to be sprayed on dicamba soybeans. Those labels were vacated by the district court in Arizona. And so there's a lot of scrambling. It was about a week that kind of figuring out what does this mean? And there was even some confusion, you know, in my camp a little bit. I had thought it was just over the top applications, but you can't just take a certain part of the label away. It was the whole label that was taken away. Right. It was the over the top applications that caused it to get pulled. But anyway, then on February 14th, on Valentine's Day, we got the existing stocks order from the EPA, and pretty much what they said, what that existing stocks order did is it said anything that was in, not in the registrant's hands, so anything in the pipeline or the channel or whatever you want to call it, being sent towards production or out of production and going towards the farmer's field was available to be used in 2024. Beyond that, it's still up in the air. But so basically all sales end on May 31st and all applications must end on June 30th, which lines up with what we already had for that. So hopefully that stays the same till June 30th.
So whatever they had in stock at the warehouse and it was already manufactured is available, or it's probably not available. It's probably already been spoken for, to be honest with you. That can still be sprayed up until June 30th.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, and that's kind of the big unknown is how much was out of the registrant's hands, because there's a lot of moving pieces there. You know, at the which warehouse was it at, right?
Right.
And so, certainly there wasn't 100% available, right? On February 6th, there were still some with the registrant. So we don't know. I would say there's likely to be a shortage, right? And you said it, probably need to be securing it, and I would agree, especially by the time this airs, to be honest, if you haven't figured out where you're getting your dye coming from, or if you haven't bought it yet, you need to be finding it really quite quickly. So they do have the cutoff date of May 31st for sales, but I think that's going to be a moot point, to be honest.
Yeah, I do too. I think it'll be gone way before then, for sure.
Oh, I agree too. And I think it, glad you mentioned the last sale date being different than the last application date, because I don't know that was clear to everybody, but that you can't buy it past May 31st and you have to have it applied by June 30th. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So you have to buy it by May 31st. Yeah. And that's, if you're a private applicator trying to buy it, or a farmer trying to buy it. So Because technically, if you're a commercial applicator, right, you know, technically it's when you're spraying it onto that field, you're selling it to the farmer, right?
Right.
But, you know, the commercial applicator, you have to have it in your possession. You know, whatever you're going to spray, you need to have that in your possession by May 31st,
if that
makes sense.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Well, I know we were in some question there. Vicki and I had a training here a couple of weeks ago, and you know, or last week, I guess it was, and you know, there was some question of whether we were going to get to have our training, and then we did. They did call us and say, yes, we're going to have our training. So a lot of good information passed along that day. And you do have to attend that training to be able to apply dicamba. Isn't that correct?
Yep, that's correct. So pretty much all the rules that were in place with the previous labels, that's kind of the way they mentioned it, is previous labels, right?
Yeah.
But whatever the last label was for that product is what you have to follow. And that includes you have to have the training and all of the other things that come with it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you haven't gotten your training yet, maybe you bought the product, but you need to have the training too to apply that product.
Absolutely. And if you can't go to an in-person one, if there's not one available to you close by, then I believe the online trainings are still open at this point. But I would go ahead and check those, because I'm not exactly sure when those close, or I'm not sure those deadlines. But but certainly. If you haven't gotten that taken care of, you need to be checking that out, because there probably won't be any in person by the time this is aired.
So. Yeah, I'm pretty confident a lot of in person ones are getting wrapped up here really
yeah.
quite
pretty
quickly,
quick.
Yeah.
Even as of today as we're recording this. But yeah, the online should still be available for anybody that still needs them, and those are pretty easy to do. I haven't checked on all three registrants, but I think all three have trainings for you available. So
Travis, update us on what happens now. What do you know? You don't know everything, and what's going to happen in the future, but tell us what you do know about the process going forward.
Yeah, so going forward, you know, it'll be the registrants. So, you know, that's Bayer, BASF, and Syngenta with those three products. Kind of working with the EPA to get a new label, since this one has been vacated, to get a new label going forward to the 2025 season and beyond. And so I know they were actively working on that almost immediately. And so what's going to happen with it, or, you know, if it's going to look different or how different it'll look, I really don't know.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
exactly.
We could all speculate, but
sure.
I do know that they, you know, almost immediately were moving forward with the EPA and having discussions with them about how they can get a new label to overcome or to make sure they're meeting the pieces that they were missing that got this vacated to continue to keep this available for farmers. Because, you know, we can debate and argue, you know, about, there's obviously some issues with the dicamba products, right? Not staying on target. But at the end of the day, there's a reason why they were brought to the market. They work really well. And I think the trade is in the soybean, so we really need to keep that product around as a viable option against some of these really troublesome weeds we have.
Oh, I agree 100%.
Any chance that the same label might come back the next year as a Section 18 label or an emergency use? Or do you think it'll be a wholesale rewriting of the label to remove some of those troublesome parts?
I would think it would probably come back as a federal label. The Section 18s are really difficult to get. And I think if you did, those would get probably challenged very, very quickly, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and I think that producers have already kind of been thinking in the last year or two of other options that are available to them if dicamba isn't an option, or if they're in a sensitive area that it's just too risky to spray a product containing dicamba. And so I think if there is a positive, we have already started thinking of other options, but we certainly don't need to lose that. I mean, because there's like you said, it's there for a reason, and I would hate to see that it completely be taken away. But you know,
well, let's just talk about that. I mean, let's just go into that, Travis. What are some options for somebody that, say, you know, they had already bought their dicamba beans and all of that, and now they can't find product? What do they do about the troublesome weeds that we always talk about? You know, water hemp and things like that. What do they do to be able to control those?
Yeah, if you're in that situation, and And I'll make the assumption that you were able to secure Extend Flex beans, right? Because that's primarily, there's still a few Extend varieties floating around, but most of the top line ones are Extend Flex, right? So we'll go off that assumption first. So the great thing about that as compared to even just a few years ago is that with the Extend Flexes, you do have glufosinate or Liberty that you can use post-emergence. So and there's always... It seems like there's always a shortage of that product too. So make sure you have that on hand as well. And it's not the cheapest product out there, but you know, we've seen glufosinate. It works really quite wonderfully against some of these weeds. And so, but I for me, the big thing is making sure you have a really good residual package, because that's, you know, regardless of what post we have out there, making sure you have a really good residual package to help you up front at the beginning of the season. And in a season like this where it's, I'm assuming that it's going to be a pretty early season for everybody based on this winter, you know, making sure you have that good residual package that'll keep you clean all the way through, you know, to your post and then possibly through canopy, and using likely another residual at that post application. So I think for those guys, leaning even harder on the residuals is kind of where I'd go. Because unfortunately, we did a trial this past year, kind of looking at, okay, the idea was trying to see, is there any old post-emergence products we can bring back into the fold, right? To rely less on, you know, dicamba, 2,4-D, and Liberty, right? Is there any way? And so we did that, and we did it on a water-hemp field, and we did it on a field that just had kind of what I call your general mix of, you know, the morning glories, giant ragweed and what such. And on our field with water hemp, you had to have either dicamba, 2,4-D, or Liberty. Otherwise you failed, right? Even with a good residual. So that's the reason those are there, and that's the reason why we want to really keep them around. But on our other fields, we do have some old options, but that, you know, that's really the big reason why we want to keep those around.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, and Vicky and I have talked about it a long time ago. We talked about, you know, we may have to dive back into some of those old chemistries that we hadn't used in a long time, especially since Roundup has come around and Roundup Ready beans have come around. You know, we're talking diving into some of those. So probably a pretty important thing that you have that information available to you and that you know what you're going to do. If you haven't made a plan, you need to make a plan. Pretty quick to kind of get that, you know, get that all taken care of. So, and see where you're going to go. And you also need to know the weeds that are going to be in your field. You know, and you need to scout. You need to know what you're trying to kill. And it's just not just a blanket deal anymore. You know, you got to know what you're trying to kill anymore.
You took the words out of my mouth. That's what I was getting ready to say is, you know, you've got to know your fields. And you know, and I think about Liberty, which is a great option, but you also got to remember that Liberty is not going to work very well on grasses. So you've got to think those things through to make sure that you've got everything covered. And most of the time you're working with somebody that's helping you decide on the best options and things like that. But it's just good to be informed and to know that, because you don't want to have a miss like that and try to clean that up. So just, you know, be prepared. That's kind of our anthem. Be prepared, you know. Yeah. And
you may have to have two or three plans. I mean, it might be one of those deals we have a shortage. You think you're going to spray Liberty and maybe there's a shortage of Liberty. So, you know, you need to be, you know, working to know what you can use, work with your supplier or with UK specialists. We're glad to help you. Folks at the Extension office will be glad to help you as well. And to plug one of those, the publication, and I can't see.
AGR6.
And be sure to stop at the Extension office and get you a copy and, you know, be able to. And that's a lot of information in there that'll be able to help people in their deciding what they're going to do about their weeds.
Yeah, speaking of that, just talk a little bit about that publication and the work that goes into that, because that is a new publication that comes out every year. Mm-hmm. And so just talk about that, because that's a tremendous publication. And if people are not using it, you know, they need to get a copy of it.
Yeah, so AGR6, so it's Weed Control and Kentucky Grain Crops, I believe is what we title it. So it's a little bit of a... The title doesn't fit exactly because we don't talk about anything besides herbicides, but that is about all we use. We do use cover crops and stuff too, but what we really do with that publication, and there's generally one of these for almost every state, but what we do is try to list every herbicide that is available to you in corn, soybean, and small grains that you can use for weed control. And so there's several different, so there's a corn section, there's actually a sorghum section too. It's very short, but there is a sorghum section, there's a soybean section, and then a small grain section. And within each of those sections, they're broken up into products you can use to burn down. There's also a section of products that you can burn down but also give you some residual control. Products that are just for applying to the soil for residual applications, and then products that you can apply after the weeds and the crop are up. So you got four sections, and within each one of those, it's basically it's a paragraph, just a short, about a half a page. Basically, we take that entire label, because these labels are dense and complicated. None of them look alike, right? And let's just be honest, nobody likes reading them, right? Because they're impossible to find anything in. So what we do is we take all the most important stuff out of the label and stick it in there. The stuff like, what rate to apply this at, what adjuvants, if it needs adjuvants, what adjuvants you need in there, what timing on the crop you can apply it to, what weeds will it control, any big environmental impacts that you need to be aware of, or big restrictions, we'll list in there, as well as crop rotation and what you can tank mix with it, right? So we try to take all that information and kind of condense it down into like one little section for every single herbicide, and just to help you kind of understand these are the products that are available to you in there. And then you still need to read the label, but we try to take the big parts of the label and feed them to you right there. But also within that, we have efficacy tables. So what those are, we list every product and basically we say it's going to kill this weed or it's not going to kill this. We do it on a number system, but eights and nines are good, fives are bad. Let's put it that way. Anything below a seven, it's not really great. You need to reevaluate your options. So, and then there's several other tables in there as well. So we try to look at it as a publication or a guide to help you with any weed control that's out there to look at what your options are. So we do update that every single year. Traditionally, we update it in October. So there might be a few products that are missing because we try to get it out by Christmas. And inevitably, there's products to get labeled after that. But if it gets labeled in the spring, you're probably not going to have a lot of product anyway. I've even debated on maybe updating even earlier as guys continue to make their decisions for the next season earlier in the year.
That's exactly what I was fixing to follow up on, is the availability on some of those things that might not make it in. Most farmers are aware of AGR6. They've been using it for a long time. It's probably one of the most comprehensive publications that the university has. And the fact that it's updated every year, I think, speaks a lot to all the work that has to go in every year by a deadline to get this out and in time in farmers' hands for it to be used. That being said, what are some of the new products for 2024 that might be in there this year that weren't included last year?
So some of the newer products that might be in there, it's really going to be a lot of products of residual products that for both corn and soybean. That's really going to be the bulk of it. So I hate saying this, but it's nothing really new. It's just new combinations of products out there. Probably in corn, probably one of the big ones would be Storin. That's going to be the new product, come from Syngenta. So they're kind of taking their old residual package and they're throwing in pyroxysulfone with it. And there's a couple of other corn products that are there, and then added in a few soybean products as well. But, I would love to sit here and say we've got 10, 15 new products. We really don't. There's a few new products. Most of them are just adjustments or adding in one or two new elements into an existing product.
Well, that I know as a crop consultant back when I first got out of college, and I mean I used that book daily, just about in the growing season, and I kept one with me in my truck, and now I mean as an agent I keep one in my office. As soon as a new one comes out, I keep it there, and because when we get calls like that, I mean that's my go to, and And we certainly, like you said, David, we've got those in our extension offices, and we'd be glad we get those to give to our folks. And so make sure you stop by if you need one and get one, because they're good to have, good resource.
Well, you know, and Travis was talking about, and he hit right on it, about, you know, the different residuals packages that you can put together. And you know, when you can't get what you're wanting, you can look in that book and you can kind of figure out something different. And, you know, it's got those tables in there, mm-hmm. that tells you whether it does a good job on the particular weed or not. And, hey, you got to get out there and scout. You know, I don't know how many times we can say that, but you got to get out there and scout and know what you're trying to kill. Because anymore, you know, Roundup, we've got some resistance to Roundup. So you just can't go spray Roundup and think everything's going to be hunky-dory. And then when you pull the combine in there, it looks like, you know, pretty woolly. Mm-hmm. So we got to know what we're doing. And I think Travis is exactly right when he's talking about residuals are going to be so important. You know, when we're spraying our burn down, we've got to have that residual. Hopefully that'll Absolutely. Get you to canopy. You know, mm-hmm. hopefully, you know, it's one of them kind of deals. But because once you get the crop up and going, she's pretty tough to handle anything that, especially if it gets any size on it, mm-hmm. you know.
That's right. And you mentioned, too, adjectives. So, I mean, just talk about that a little bit, too, because there's different ones, and different ones need to be used with different products, and some don't need to be used with other products. And just touch on that a little bit.
I'll interrupt. To me, that's probably the most handy part of that book, is the different sections that talk about what chemicals play nice together in the tank and what don't. To me,
because they all don't play well together.
That's exactly right. So go ahead. But that to me is a big, very useful part of it.
Yeah. And so even at that, adjuvants can still be amazingly confusing.
Mm-hmm. Right? I agree.
There's so many of them out there. So, you know, when you think about your post-emergence products, you know, most of them need some type of adjuvant with it. And so mm-hmm. what those adjuvants are doing is they are helping you get that product into the plant. If you take a step back and think about the concept of, you know, we're putting 10 to 15 gallons, if I'm being generous, of water out on a field, 10 gallons per acre, which you think about over an acre, that's not really that much, right? Mm-hmm. And within that 10 mm-hmm. gallons, there's just a little tiny bit of herbicide, and we're expecting that to get into every single weed yep. and to kill it. And the honest truth is, only about maybe 10 to 20% of that product finds its final target to kill that weed, which is just amazing. And so, mm-hmm. And we're using water because that's the easiest thing to use, but we're using water to apply a lot of products that don't like being in water onto a plant that has a waxy cuticle that resists water, right?
Yep.
And we're expecting to get it into that plant. And that's what adjuvants are doing for you. And, you know, right. we do this demonstration where you just, you know, we take a piece of wax paper and we drop a droplet of water on it. And what does it do? It beads up and it rolls mm-hmm. off, right? Just like a yep. waxed vehicle. And the same thing happens to a plant, but we have to have the adjuvants in there to get it to stick to that plant. And then also to help us get into that plant. And yep. so there's a lot of herbicides. The packages, they, you know, they throw in a lot of those adjuvants in the jug, right? There's a lot yep. of adjuvants in the jug, but they can't put every single adjuvant in there. And so that's why in that guide, it's really important to pay attention to, here's the adjuvant you need to use. And that might also change depending on the environment, right?
Yep.
If we get into really dry environments with really thick cuticles, you might have to change up your adjuvant. It all depends on the product too.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you have to use the right adjuvant to also protect your crop.
Yep.
Because, you know, we'll just say, you know, you put MSO in certain herbicide mixes and you're going to get some nice burn on your crop, right?
Pretty hot, pretty quick.
Right? Yeah,
you
got to right.
heat it up.
Yeah, exactly. So, and maybe that's what you need to kill the weeds, but, you know, so that's, you know, that's what adjuvants are doing for us. And they even go beyond that. You have adjuvants that are also conditioning your water, right?
Right.
In Kentucky, we have hard water, so we have to make sure, you know, that's not antagonizing products like glyphosate. Mm-hmm. So using an AMS or any other water conditioner that binds up those cations, so it's not binding to our glyphosate, right? So there's those, and now, you know, you have volatility reduction agents with the dicamba products, and you have drift reduction agents as well. So, you know, really determining when is the appropriate time to use those, mm-hmm. Because The drift reduction agents increase your droplet size, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But that may not always be a great thing for every product.
I was going to ask you how does those drift retardants, how do those things affect the efficacy of the chemicals that you're trying to put on?
So it really kind of depends on the product, right? So if you're doing a systemic product, let's just say like dicamba, for the most part, it's not going to reduce your efficacy, right? Because it's a systemic product. If we can just get it onto that plant, it'll get to where it needs to be. But if you're using something like glufosinate or one of the PPO inhibitors that we rely on coverage, mm-hmm. we don't want those in there, right? Because those are contact products. We got to have good coverage. Mm-hmm. And a drift reduction agent, while doing a good job of keeping things from drifting,
right.
They don't get you good coverage.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I was wondering that, and I mean, that's a great a part of that book that Jay was talking about. You know, that's all of those things are in that book that'll help you, you know, as Vicky says, play well together. And mm-hmm. you want that.
Oh, yeah.
If you've ever been spraying and had a tank full of something that was separated, is not a good it's not a good outcome for anybody. And I have done that. And so that was way before we were using a lot of those things. So, you know, when I worked at and in the private industry, we had a situation where that happened, and it was pretty tough to get all that, you know, because you had to do something with that, and then you had to rinse and clean and all that kind of stuff. So
yeah, those are nightmare scenarios that nobody forgets.
I didn't forget it. I promise you.
Yeah.
And the thing about when you're spraying herbicides too, I mean, they tell on you if you mess up.
Yep.
You know, everybody in the world's going to see it, and most of the time you're going to mess up right on the road, and sometimes those certain adjuvants or products work really well to clean your tank out, right?
Yep.
So you think you got your tank all cleaned out, and then you don't. So, you know, I think we need to make sure we know, you know, that part too. But the other thing too is, you know, you was talking about. The just like water conditioners and things like that. Talk a little bit about the importance on the order when you're mixing products. There is an order that you need to do that in, because if not, you're going to have the trouble that you're mm-hmm. talking about, David. Yep. So talk about that for just a little bit.
Yeah. So, and we'll be pretty general here, but yeah, for the most part, the way we recommend tank mixing is to just kind of work from the things that are hardest to get into the water to the things that are the easiest, right? Yeah. That's kind of the way I think about it. But, you know, water conditioners, we really want those in first because they're there to condition your water, right? So if they're not in there first, they're not necessarily conditioning your water or tying up those hard water cations. Those processes are reversible. So if you put in your glyphosate first and go, oh, no, I forgot my AMS, you can still put it in there and help yourself out. Those processes do reverse themselves, but you're a lot better off putting it in first, right? So any water conditioners, we like to have those in the first, and then any dry products. So those are products you got to get into solution, right? And if you've ever mixed a dry product, you know how difficult those can tend to be. You have to do a lot of agitation to get them in. But so get those in first, and then anything, you know, any EC or anything that's kind of an oil-based product, the oily products is a lot of time what we say, put those in next, because those are next most difficult to get in. And then you can put in stuff like glyphosate or dicamba or 2,4-D, mm-hmm. our water-based kind of, our products that kind of like being in water, right?
Yep.
And then lastly, we put in adjuvants. And if you're using micronutrients, we usually say those are the very last things to put into the tank.
You know, I think about the video that you have out on the Plant Soil Science website that Cats with Coffee that I show at my pesticide training, because I think it's really important the order of what you put your stuff in. And, you know, you can see where that dry goes right into that EC, and it coats it with oil, and it just doesn't break down, and it doesn't ever get into solution at all.
Yep.
You know, and I think we have a lot of that happen because people are just not, you know, when you hire somebody at the co-op, you know, you don't go, we got to go through this training because I need you to know what order to put the stuff in. That does not happen. I know that because I went through that. Nobody ever told me the order of which you were supposed to put your stuff in your chemicals in your tank. So, I mean, it does make a difference.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. And, you know, it's just one of those things that we just take for granted sometimes.
Yeah.
Even myself, I tell you, here's what you should apply, but I never tell you how to mix it or how to apply it, right? We just assume that you know how to do that. And I also do think, you know, it goes back to the Roundup Ready age, you know, when all we're doing is just Roundup. It's pretty easy to tank mix, or it's pretty easy. Just put the Roundup in, right?
Yep. So that's right.
I think, you know, we are going back putting a lot more stuff into the tank, and it's you know, time to step back and think about all those processes.
As we talk about that, talk about how to clean your tank, what the process is to get that tank. Like if you're going from one crop to another or going one field to another and you're spraying completely different substances, tell us the best way to clean that tank.
So the best way to make sure that tank, to make sure that sprayer is clean, right?
Right.
That's the key, because you can have your tank clean.
Yeah, that's right.
But there's so much more to that sprayer, especially these large sprayers. There's so much more than just the tank, right?
Yep.
You've got all the plumbing, all the filters between the tank and the boom, right? There's not just one on most of these. There's multiple, making sure all those filters are clean and making sure the entire boom's clean.
Right.
And really, that's a triple rinse process. And that's really the best way, is to do a triple rinse. So that's making sure that there's water that goes through each of those items three times, right? So you fill up the majority of the tank the first time with water, get everything cleaned out, make sure that water runs through everything to pull out. And it's really just a big dilution process. You're not cleaning, may not be the right word. It's really diluting it until there's a concentration that's so low that we're not having an effect on the next crop. And so with the triple rinse, is that's what's going to get you there, is making sure each of those items gets rinsed three times. And then a lot of guys like to use tank cleaners, and I think that's fine. Usually sometimes it's between the second and third rinse that they use those. But I think for me, the big key is a tank cleaner is not a replacement for a triple rinse. So, and the other thing is, you know, the tank cleaner shouldn't be the last thing in there, because tank cleaners can injure crops too.
Yep. You know, how many times have we been out on a call that the first load, it dinged it, you know, and you can step to the row of where they stopped and, you know, it's fine. But that first, you know, or when they first turn their booms on and take off in the field, it's 20 or 30 feet there that it just, it whacked it. You know, and just burnt the fire out of it, you know. And, and you know, how many times has that happened? I mean, I can't even count.
You see it every year.
Yeah.
You do. And like I said, those are the ones that's always going to be on the road where everybody can see it too. Those those kinds of things don't happen, you know, way off the road. Yeah, it's going to happen where everybody can see it. But, you know, and I want to just always remind people too, is, you know, you have to keep records. That's not just a suggestion. That really is what you have to do. And to make sure that you do a good job with those records, and not just because you have to. I mean, yes, you have to do that, but keep good records, because then you can go back and look at those later on, even a year down the road, and you look back, or when in the fall when you say, man, something didn't work here. You know, we had a breakthrough here. Let me go back and see what we sprayed, when we sprayed it. What was the weather conditions at the time that you sprayed it? Was it that the product didn't, did you have a product failure? Was it that
did
it,
you have an applicator failure?
Or, you know, was it that you're the a weather, you know, it, you know, a weather changed on you? Because that can help you make decisions in the next year, and and be able to know what you used and if it worked or not. And so do a good job on your records, and think of it that way, instead of just that it's just something else that you're required to do. You know, you got to do it, so you might as well do it in a way that you can use it to help you as well, you know. But
you know, all that's on the label, and we never read the label.
That label that we don't like to read.
That's right. you know, but the other thing, and I got Vicky at our training the other day, a gentleman was talking about he didn't have all of his records on how the susceptible crops around where he was spraying, and he got a fine. And so we really do need to do a better job and with our record keeping. And something that came to mind, Vicky, while you were telling that is, we were thinking about dicamba, is temperature inversions. And we didn't even mention that a while ago. And I really want Travis, before, you know, we get too far into the deal, for him to explain that to folks and to talk about why it's important to not spray during that time.
Yeah, so a temperature inversion, and this will apply to any herbicide, right? This isn't just dicamba. I know it's most specific on the dicamba label, but so what a temperature inversion is these are pretty common throughout the summer overnight. And what it is when you get cool air trapped underneath warm air. And again, it usually happens at night. So the example I like to give is, you know, if you've ever been, you know, on an ATV or on a truck with the windows down, on a summer night and a summer evening, and you're going through hills and valleys, right? You go down into that valley and you feel that really cold air, and you come up to the top and it, you know, you feel it warm up. You just went through a temperature inversion. That's what that is. In that valley, there's cold air that got trapped underneath the warm air. And usually that happens overnight. And so what happens is during the day, you know, the sun is heating the ground, and then the ground is heating the air that's directly above it, and hot air rises, right? So the hot air will rise up, and that's the time when you want to be spraying, because if you do have any fines that get caught in there, they're just going to go up, right? And and when we think about pollution, it's the same thing. We want they always think about, you know, nice sunny days, everything's going up, so any pollution goes up and out, right? So but during a temperature inversion, that usually happens once the sun goes down. You get some cold air that starts to get trapped underneath that warm air that's been heating all day long, right? And you get that cold air trapped. Excuse me. So that cold air gets trapped underneath of there, and it doesn't go anywhere. So if you spray into that, if there's any fine droplets that get caught in there, they're just going to stay in that air.
Yeah.
And those temperature inversions, we have no control over where they go, right?
Right.
They can go, they can travel a long ways. Usually they go downhill, right? Because it's cold air. So if it happens that, if you happen to do it at an elevation and there's something below, we do know where it's going to go. It's going to go down at that point in time. And then it's eventually going to drop out and more than likely onto vegetation we don't want it on to. And so in the next morning when the sun comes up, starts heating that ground, or the wind starts to blow, it'll break up that inversion and everything kind of goes away. But, you know, everybody always thought, you know, during the middle of the day, the wind blows, so I don't want to spray. So I want to spray first thing in the morning, as soon as the sun's out, or right at night, right? But it turns out that's the wrong time to do it, because first thing in the morning, you still have an inversion. It takes a little bit for that sun to get out and to warm things up before the inversion goes away. And we've seen where inversions will start setting up 1 to 2 hours before sundown. And so that's why why it's on the label. And again, you know, the example with the ATV or the truck with the windows down, usually that's well after the sun's gone down, and that's when they're really strong. But they start setting up much before that, and we don't necessarily feel them, but they're there.
Well, one of the things I've always used is a visual. Those first frosts in the fall, or maybe those last frosts that we have in the spring, are going to be in those lowest areas. And that's something that people can see. They can see that little piece of that bottom that has a frost on it. While maybe slightly uphill, there's not any. I've kind of always used that as a visual of that cold air sinking to that low spot.
So.
Yeah, it was one of the things in the training they were talking about is you're not supposed to spray, an hour after daylight and then 2 hours before it gets dark. So, I mean, that folks need to keep that in mind for sure.
And that can travel a good distance, too. I mean, like you said, we have no control over that. And so sometimes that can travel.
Yeah, if you're down in down in a bottom that's nice and flat, right, and you're at the lowest elevation, you know, they can travel miles.
Yeah.
You know, we have no control over where they travel at that point in time. And, you know, there's no wind, so they're just kind of, it moves around, and it can go a long way. So if you're in a big, flat, open area, it's pretty incredible how far these inversions will move.
And I know like you said, we think about that more with dicamba, just because when dicamba came back on the scene, so to speak, that was one of the things that we started talking about, and that was like something that we all learned about again, you know, because we hadn't thought about it. But
it's such a distinct look.
It is.
You have dicamba damage. I mean, that cut leaf, you know, it's such a distinct look.
Yeah, and I think the other part was that we were spraying, you know, we have a crop out there, soybean, that is so sensitive to dicamba at such a low rate, and that's why all of these things really kind of flared up.
Yeah. You know, you take, like, growth regulator injury that we see in the spring, people using 2,4-D as a corn burn down. There's not a lot of things out there that are susceptible to that. Certain areas there are, if you have horticultural crops and things like that, maybe greenhouses, certainly there are. But typically there's not another field crop that's out there, maybe in close proximity, that's going to show any of that.
Right.
But with soybeans, it's totally different because it could be surrounded by susceptible crops, literally.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yep.
Just another one of the ways that we could get damage from, you know, before we end the show, I did want to make mention of, you know, sprayer boom height, how important sprayer boom height is to off-target damage, you know. And again, one of your videos, you know, you talk about that and about, you know, and I've seen lots of guys, their booms are 6 foot above the, you know, a canopy of soybeans, and I understand that. I drove a sprayer for a long several years, and I understand that slapping the end of the boom. We ain't got time for that, Jay.
slapping too many acres to cover.
That's right. Slapping the boom and breaking something, or you know, and how costly time wise that is. So, but the fact of the matter is, you need to be a lot closer than 6 foot. You know, at 24 inches, I think is. Yeah. Is from the canopy now. Yeah. That's you need to be.
Yeah, I was going to say from what you're trying to kill. I mean, that's the difference too. Is whatever you're trying to kill is it, that's, you know, and I think too sometimes applicators don't realize. I mean, maybe it doesn't look like it's quite that high.
Right.
I mean,
it's deceiving.
It is. You know, I don't spray, but I mean, I know that sometimes, you know, it may not look like that, but boy, I have been driving down the road and look over and.
Just turn the other way.
Yeah. You just kind of go, You just kind of.
Yep.
But, you know, that's. Yep. But good reminder. I'm glad you brought that up, because that is something that's you can't say too much either.
Yep. You know? That's right. You know, that off target. It's not good for anybody. It's not good for their, you know, the chemicals that we have available. You know, we want to keep these chemicals in our toolboxes. We want to be able to use them.
Yeah.
But we've got to be responsible, and we've got to do the right thing, too.
And just be aware of your surroundings.
Yep.
I mean, just when you pull into the field to spray, just take a look around. And just don't get in too big of a hurry that you're not paying attention to what is around you. Because like you said, Jay, a greenhouse can turn into a costly problem for you. And you just not realize that it was there. And so just take a minute, look around before you start spraying.
Spraying any kind of insecticide, be aware of honeybees around.
Absolutely.
Very important.
Yeah.
So. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Travis, we'll get ready to wrap things up here in a minute, but I think we need to come back at some other time and maybe do a show, talk a little bit more about efficacy of chemicals, and talk a little bit about just getting good coverage. Maybe do a little talk on nozzle selection and talk about gallons per acre of water coverage, because it's different for different products.
Yeah, I think those, that again, like I said, we talk all the time about what you should spray, but not how to spray, right? So, I'd love to do that. And the last thing I'll mention here is on AGR6, on the weed control guide. You know, if anybody listening, if you're looking at that thing and you're just like, man, I wish they had this piece of information about every product in here, let your agent know and tell them to tell me, because we're always looking to try to make that publication better. So if there's a piece of information that's missing, let us know, and I'm happy to update it the best I can.
Absolutely.
It's a publication. Yeah. It's been around a long time. As a publication, even though it gets updated every year, I know I'll go back nearly 30 years now. When I was a new agent, it was like my Bible that I carried around everywhere, because it taught me so much in such a short amount of time about all the different chemicals we were using at the time. So, sounds good. Well, you know, towards the end of the show, we always like to wrap things up with a timely tip. You had said something in there that kind of caught Vicky's ear at the time, and she made some notes and passed them to me. We thought a good timely tip right now for this time of the year would be prepared of product shortages of some of the post-applied products that you may be using, and have a good backup plan to help work with that. It's a really good time to remember to use residual products to help with season-long control, especially when we're looking at some of these shortages of other products, especially the dicamba that we may run into. So anything you want to add to that?
Nope, I think that's great advice. So I would say have a plan A, B, and maybe even a plan C.
We've said that before.
Folks have heard that before, yep.
Well, Travis, we thank you a bunch for coming in here and doing the show with us today. We want to thank you for this week's information, and thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.